Blog Talk Radio.
This is Jennifer Neely, and this is the A-List, coming to you live from the San Francisco Bay Area. Every week, our shows focus on the intersection of technology, media, and entrepreneurship or business with influencers and change makers around the globe. As you hopefully know, you are a vital part of the program, at least to me, and I look forward to always seeing your emails and questions about the various guests that we have on the show today, or any day. Today we have kind of a unique guest. His name is Simon Mainwaring. Why can't I say his name correctly? But anyway, he is the CEO and founder of We First Branding. And so you think to yourself, what is a branding expert writing a book about? You might think that it would be about branding, but it's actually not. It's actually about social change and how we can make social change happen in a very significant way through the many crises that we've seen and take lessons from those and actually help to change the world in a positive way. And there's sort of a two-pronged approach to the book. One is actually how the brands of the world can embrace social change and make a major contribution to the world through the billions of dollars that they have. And the other side of that is what we can do as ordinary citizens on a daily basis to make change, and what that change actually means. So I think a lot of people in the past, depending on what generation we're from, have said, you know, well, what does my change mean? Why do I matter in the scheme of things? And the book, We First, really goes from this I approach, which, you know, as you know from my generational marketing background, is very much about the generation of I. And we go from I to we. And with us, I believe, is Simon Mainwaring. Simon, yes. Is that you?
Yes, it is. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you? Can you hear me all right, Simon?
Did I just lose you there?
No, I'm here. Are you there?
I am there. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
You
sound like you're...
I dropped my phone.
Oh, no. That's never a good thing.
No, that's never a good thing. So, pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So, welcome to the A-List. And let's start off with an overview of the book, because I think what I was just saying is some people might be surprised for a branding expert such as yourself who works with large companies to be writing a book about social change, about what companies can do and what individuals can do.
Well, I have to say, you know, in as much as we wear our professional hat every day, we also have our personal hat. And the transition for me came when, you know, I was in my early 40s, I've got two young kids, and I'd worked on a number of different nonprofits, and I really started to get a sense of how much trouble they're in. And as I saw my own kids coming of age, I realized, well, what's my responsibility to them? What sort of world am I going to leave behind? And my father passed away. So, you know, I just became really mindful of the personal hats that we wear as parents or as men and women. And then also, at the same time, there was a happy coincidence, because I looked at all this social technology that's out there and went, wow, this could be potentially transformative. Not as a tech geek in a sense, but more as a branding guy who's spent his whole life trying to create connections between people to change thinking or behavior, and suddenly this new technology came along that made that so easy. So I thought, there's a way to make a greater contribution by leveraging this social technology in the service of social change. And so it was a nice marriage of the personal and the professional side of my life.
That's a nice thing to hear. And it sounds like, and you touch on this in the video that people can see on Amazon.com, and I'm sure other places that talk about, where you actually talk about the book. But it seems like you mentioned, and you touch on this a bit, but I'd like to expand on it further. It seemed like the world was sort of ripe for this. I would imagine probably around, and forgive me if I'm, or correct me if I'm wrong, but around the time you were writing this, there was the financial meltdown, And a lot of people that were saying people over profit, as you've rightly pointed out in the book synopsis. Talk a little bit about the time in which you were writing and how you felt the message might resonate to a group of people ready to hear it, because that's obviously very important.
No, you're so right. And firstly, I'd say the idea of We First, you can find the book at wefirstbook.com. It's not an idea that I can own or anyone can own. It exists in the collective. The only reason We First exists is for exactly the reasons you just said, which is I looked around, and like everyone else, I felt that we'd been sort of betrayed or misled to a large extent in 2008, and I felt like we need to do something about it. And so We First exists as a platform from which to celebrate everybody else out there that's doing some good, that is looking at the world through the lens of their own concerns, but also the interests of others. So, what I've tried to do with my blog for the last 3 years is celebrate every individual, nonprofit, social entrepreneur, brand, or advertising agency that is really trying to do something positive. So please do think of We First as a platform to celebrate all the work of others. And it's a mindset, a way of looking at the world that says, hey, we're in this together now. If we look at 2008, what happened on Wall Street affected Main Street, affected Greece, affected Iceland, affected the EU.
We can now
talk to anyone on the other side of the world in real time, instantaneously. So we really do live in a global community. So what does that mean for business? What does that mean for consumers? What does that mean for parents? And that's really what it's about.
And so for people that, it's interesting because I study generational marketing and how generations are very different. Is that something that you've noticed, given that you've been in this business for quite some time? You're an
authority, hundreds of years. I've been in this business for hundreds of years.
I feel like that about digital technology, so trust me, I know where you're coming from. But, it seems like this generation more than any is really, meaning the millennial generation, is very, very ripe to take this on. So it's really, I really want to make a clear distinction, and help me if I'm off on this, or maybe you can elaborate. But, a lot of companies, a lot of people are sort of getting turned off by this idea that came from the Edelman Obama case study of, we can make lots of social advocates. It's really not about social advocacy. It's really more about something else, and that something else is what I'd like you to kind of elaborate on.
Right. The way I describe it is really sort of social activism. I mean, sometimes activism is misconstrued as, taking to the streets or sort of violent protest, but it's not that. It's really just putting action behind the things that you care about. And really, I think when I look back at my understanding of recent history, every change of any substance has really occurred when people align around shared values and get to work. And that connective tissue between people, that emotional connection, is what drives everything. And this technology is in the service of that. So, I'm not a digital native. I didn't, grow up with the internet in that sense. But, I do recognize a tool that can be used to those ends. And so, really, I don't think things will change unless we all take responsibility for the change that we do want to see in the world. And I mean that both as brands and as corporate executives and so on, but also as consumers, because we can't sit back and go, I'm just going to buy whatever I want or overconsume however I like, and I'm going to ignore the negative impact the companies are having on the environment or the life of their employees or the increased number of poor or people who are on food stamps here in the United States. We need to get mobilized behind what we care about, because unless we leverage our buying power as consumers, unless we say to companies, we're going to engage our purchasing power to impact your bottom line in a way to encourage you to be socially responsible, nothing's really going to change. There's no motivation for them to change. So, it's social activism on behalf of consumers, but also on behalf of brands. And together we can create this third pillar I talk about of social change, where the private sector can become a force for positive change, as well as commerce and profit, in addition to government and philanthropy.
I'm wondering where NGOs fit in this equation, or large organizations that span the globe. You're originally from Australia, I gather.
Yes.
And I just got a CNN breaking news alert that ex-IMF chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn pled not guilty to sexual assaults.
Sure.
And, you know, things like that have amazing resonance, as we know, around the world.
Right.
You mentioned very rightly the effect, and I always feel guilty. My husband's English, so every time I go back to the UK, don't hold that against me, please. especially in terms of cricket. But every time we go back to the UK, you know, there's this sort of sense of how much more difficult things seem to be there than they are, say, in the San Francisco Bay Area, and how
right.
much more people are sacrificing around the world because of the mistakes that financiers and others made here in the United States.
Right.
And so I'm just wondering, you know, with this sort of news just popping up on my iPhone, what that might mean for large global institutions, especially that handle money, and what people can do about that or should do about that. I mean, it is a private matter at the end of the day to some extent, but this person
right.
symbolizes money at a time where money needs really to have a good face on it.
I totally understand your question. There's several things I'd say. I mean, firstly, for too long, the corporate veil has protected, you know, transgressions of, you know, duties of executive officers. You know, it's a personal issue when people make choices like that and so on. But as a general statement, I would say that for a long time, we really didn't see behind the corporate veil, behind the boardroom door. And as long as a company executed its duty to shareholders and so on, it was fine. Everyone was seen to be happy. But we now need an understanding where we have a duty to society at large, because what happens in those boardrooms, or what happens when people, you know, make transgressions such as just happened there with the IMF, you know, it affects people around the world. It affects trust. It affects perceptions of industries. It affects confidence in the markets and you know, in our sort of business leaders. And this has a negative effect. But also, I think we need to accept the fact that we all have several hats now that we need to wear. And even if you're a shareholder, even if all you care about is the bottom line of a company, you still wear several other hats as a stakeholder in the well-being of society, as a parent, as someone who cares about the environment. And we need to end this false separation between living and giving, where, you know, as long as companies make their profit, it doesn't matter what negative impact they have on the environment. And then the only time that they're going to give is when they've got some money left over through the corporate foundation or whatever. And often that's, you know, that's image management, or sometimes it's done disingenuously, or, you know, some people perceive it as cause washing. We really need to say the practice of capitalism needs to be sustainable. And we almost, you know, came unstuck globally in 2008. So we need to not do away with capitalism. We just need to temper that balance. We've gone too far. We need to bring it back, and we need to integrate purpose into profit and not make it this afterthought, because the system as we're running it right now is unsustainable. We have 40 million Americans on food stamps. We have 42 million Americans below the government set poverty line. This is unacceptable, and it's unconscionable. Then we've got, you know, over a billion people under $1.25 a day, living under $1.25 a day around the world. And when you consider the erosion of the middle class here in the United States, the ranks of the poor that keep growing every day, and the smaller and smaller group of people that seem to be doing disproportionately well, we have to change this, not just because, you know, it's not right morally, but because it's unsustainable from a business point of view. Companies cannot survive in societies that fail. So if we keep this mindset going on, this me-first mindset, as opposed to the we-first mindset I outline in the book, we really will come unstuck on several levels that will hurt companies as well. So it's not that it's not smart business, it's actually dumb business. This is a bad way to run the planet right now, and we need to temper it.
Absolutely. I think, I mean, your message resonates with me as a former Peace Corps volunteer, and part of what I do here is try to give a good platform to a variety of different kinds of people. And so I wonder, you know, are there people that inspired you along the way in terms of writing the book, in terms of your journey of coming to understand the sort of ending the separation, as you say, between living and giving?
Yeah, there were several people, but I'll give you two direct experiences. Well, firstly, you know, my wife is Egyptian, and I've spent a lot of time in the Middle East, and I've seen a lot of real poverty that is heartbreaking, and I'm just one of those guys where it does affect me. I'd love to say I'm cold-hearted and I can look at it and not care as long as I'm okay, but it's not true. You know, I can't help but feel badly about that and really struggle to understand why we're not running things more efficiently and spreading prosperity more fairly. Then secondly, I would say I was speaking to a non-profit leader a few years ago when I was talking to them, and they said something off the cuff that they didn't even notice, but it was so powerful to me. They said, the person who sees the problem is the one with the responsibility to fix it. And it really struck me, because we sit there going, as long as I'm okay, government will take care of everything. Oh, well, government's now got historic debt. Well, then non-profits will take care of everything. But non-profits can't meet the scale of the challenges we face. They don't have the resources. Oh, well, then I guess companies will. But no, it's got to come back to the private sector and all of us now. And then the third influence that was really, really powerful to me was, you know, I was at a bit of a loss professionally. I'd had a cool job and I'd had a big job in the advertising world, but I felt unfulfilled sort of as a man and as a father, and I was at a bit of a loss. And I read the transcript to the speech that Bill Gates gave at the World Economic Forum, his creative capitalism speech. And he just said, you know, government and philanthropy can't fix the world on their own. We need the private sector to get involved. And the truth of that really struck me deeply, like this massive machine of companies and customers exchanging billions of dollars each day, they must be able to do a better job of helping the less fortunate out there. And so that was a real catalyst for me getting engaged. So it was personal and professional again, but it's always inspired by other people who for some reason has come to this awareness themselves and said, we can make a greater contribution. It's in our own interest to do it. Plus we get the fulfillment of improving the lives of others.
That's fantastic. Now, you talked about shifting the focus of your blog in the last 5 years to include examples, case studies of where this has taken place. And I would love to get some insight for those that haven't done the research that I've done to share with them some of those insights that you've gathered.
Oh, and there's so many great examples. I mean, you know, the book is a response to really so many indicators out there. It's really just a way of distilling down something that's happening independent of the book that's out there everywhere. And some examples, you've got, you know, platforms like CauseCast, which does Huffington Post Impact, which marries brands with nonprofits. So, you know, a brand can make a contribution to nonprofits. You've got mobile applications like Social Vest, which allow people to buy a product and a small portion of it will go towards a cause of your choosing. You've got, you know, applications like Swipe Good, which allow you to round up the purchase of every purchase you make on a credit card, and that to go to a cause that you choose. And, you know, you've got big brands doing wonderful work, whether it's Nike's support of the Live Strong campaign or whether Patagonia right now is just leading what is called the Sustainable Apparel Coalition, where as an extension of Patagonia's Footprint Chronicles, where they show how their products were made, where they were manufactured, what the products were made out of, what's the impact on the environment, they've now extended this to the entire apparel industry, and it's called the Sustainable Apparel Coalition. They've included everybody in the outdoor apparel industry, including their competitors like Timberland, including big behemoths like, you know, Walmart and M&S over in the UK, and they actually have on board now 30% of the global apparel making market is now part of this program of sustainability and transparency with a view to minimizing the negative impact on the environment. And that to me is an indication of what we can achieve if we get our priorities right. So whether you're standing in the shopping aisle with a mobile app like Good Guide, which allows you to point your phone at a carton of orange juice and see the social impact of that product before you put it in your shopping cart, or whether you buy products from a member of the Sustainable Apparel Coalition, we can become mindful rather than mindless shoppers, and we can turn our shopping carts from monuments to self-interest and to excess and negative impact into a force incrementally for change, and I think that's really exciting.
It absolutely is. What I think is interesting, too, is some of the you know, in terms of the early information I got to read about the book, you have some great testimonies for the book. One I have on the Blog Talk Radio site about from Gary Vaynerchuk of Crush It about, you know, living it, which is, you know, basically what you're saying. And I wonder, you know, how much of, if any, you know, you start self-censoring the sort of circle of friends that you start including in writing books like this to those that you know care about social good. I mean, I'll give you a personal example. You know, there's people that I admire as investors, but, you know, they'll say funny, what they think are funny things, but they really do mean them, which is, you know, the money never lies, money has no morals, things
like that,
which go against what I believe fundamentally. And I wouldn't want a testimonial from them. And you strike me as someone where that would be the case as well. So, you know, when it came down to praise for your book, did you find yourself going to specific people that you felt kind of could live the or prove out what your book talks about?
Sure. I mean, firstly, there's a larger context of authors out there, like Gary with Crush It and Brian Solis with Engage and Chris Brogan with Trust Agents. You know, and Gary again with Thank You Economy. They're all responding to basically the rehumanizing of business. We're all examining the new dynamics in which brands are becoming human and more humans are becoming brands. So there's a like-mindedness there, which is why you reach out to them. But I've also had critics. I mean, the critics are mostly people who are cynical in the sense they'll say big business will never change. And I agree that they're absolutely right if we don't change. And what I mean by that is, if we as consumers don't leverage our buying power to impact the bottom line of brands, they've got no reason to change. Their incentive scheme hasn't changed. They still get paid on the basis of meeting analyst projections in the next quarter and getting stock options based on that. So if we can't impact their bottom line, this is absolutely just naive idealism and kumbaya. And that would be the theme of critics that have been out there who have heard this message or who haven't, you know, had the luxury of reading the book, but just, you know, hear it at first blush and go, you know, we want business to do good. They see that either business will not change, which I think is fair if consumers don't change, or secondly, they'll do it disingenuously. And for the second objection, I would say I'm encouraged by three things. One is, we live in an era in the last 3 years of greater transparency than ever before. When you look at WikiLeaks, when you look at the hacking of Sony multiple times, nothing's sacred anymore in terms of, you know, a company trying to hide its information. Secondly, there is greater distrust than ever before by consumers. If you look at the great report that the world's largest PR firm, Edelman, just came out with their trust barometer, there is less trust of brands now than in 2008. Which means all of us customers out there, the people that are going to line their pockets and make their money, distrust them more than ever. So they've got to win back that trust. And then thirdly, I think consumers, how do I put this politely, their BS radar, their sensitivity, their sensitivity to when companies are just pulling your leg and saying one thing, greenwashing, cause washing, local washing, is more sensitive than ever. Every time a company tries to delete a post off a Facebook page or off its Twitter stream, everything blows up in its face. When BP comes out, you know, when BP doctors photographs or doesn't show the right footage or comes out with double page newspaper spread ads after the oil spill in Mexico, people don't buy it. So I think, yes, companies will do it disingenuously, but at the same time, the customer is more sophisticated than ever before.
So one question I would say is a bit of a challenging one. I mean, I've worked with a lot of consumer-facing companies, but I work with as many, and I'm sure you have as well, you know, B2B companies or that have companies that are either completely B2B focused or are focusing a large portion of their business on business-to-business modeling, where it's a little bit harder to change behavior because there's possibly fewer vendors or companies that are doing things in a very excellent way. And getting to those people, those decision makers is a little different. The personalities of those decision makers can be very different. What would you say in the case of B2B companies?
You know, the funny thing is, I like you, I've worked around a lot of companies that are B2B and B2C. And contrary to popular opinion, they're all full of human beings. I mean, we're actually good people. And what my real strength, well, my real sense of everything is that even in the B2B marketplace, the business-to-business marketplace, we still need a community. And when you have a series of vendors, when you have a series of companies that you work with or, you know, people you see on a daily basis, they have a choice of working with other people, and they have a choice about whether they promote their association with you. And when you have a values proposition, when you reach out to them and say, look, this is what we stand for, and you see that in the way we communicate and the way you interact with us, that strengthens that relationship, and it, you know, solidifies that community. If you don't, and you're cynical or you're inconsistent, they're more likely to go somewhere else. So I think it's just as relevant to B2B, because we all have so many choices now as to who we associate with, who we work with, and, you know, the relationships between people is what's important. We're both in the relationship management business now, and we're in the reputation management business, because social media allows your vendor, your B2B client, to talk about you as a brand just as the same way it lets a customer talk about you.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. I think it's an unrelated point, actually, in some ways, but I have to ask you this because in different parts of the world. Are you still with me?
Yeah, I'm still with you. I'm just I've got that wonderful New York soundtrack in the background, which is, you know, car honks and sirens. No matter where you go, you can't escape. So I just tried
true.
To hide that from you.
That's okay.
Yeah.
The New York sounds, I think, probably a lot of people out there probably enjoy on a Monday morning, right?
Right.
Or at least in Pacific time. So one thing that I would say is, you know, my sister-in-law, my nephews, and brother-in-law all live in Australia, and I consistently note, and some of the companies that I've worked with recently are Australian companies, and they do seem to have deeper pockets and have been hit, and maybe it's a delayed response, maybe I'm wrong in saying this tomorrow, bad things will happen, but do you look at sort of where you've come from and feel like there's a difference in perception of money, and that maybe there's, because I mean there's definitely companies that are making, have lots of opportunity to come to the States and make money because of the weakness of the dollar, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
How does that sort of factor in, kind of where you come from and that sort of thing?
You know, it's an interesting question. I haven't really thought about that so many times before, but here's the thing. My attitude and the inspiration for the book came from being Australian and then working in London for a long time, working on European clients, and now 12 years in the States. And my mother's Hungarian, my father's Australian, my wife is Egyptian, and my daughters are American. So
you sound like me.
we're a bit so. You know, a bit of this, a bit of that. I'm a bit so, you know. And so it's more of being a global citizen, as pretentious as that sounds, in the sense that you just keep jumping around and wherever you are is home. And also, having worked with non-profits as well as for-profits, you become very sensitive to the reality of the suffering that's going on the ground on a daily basis. And here's the more important distinction than nationality, I think. There are those in the world that are trying to survive, and there are those who are trying to prosper. And most of the developing world, and tragically an increasing proportion of the developed world, like many Americans, are literally struggling to survive, not even to keep their health care, just to pay their bills. And that's the reality that informs a lot of people's experience of life. It gets very hard to say, hey, I want to be more mindful of others or give more when I can barely survive myself. And that shouldn't make us hopeless. All that says is the way that we're running the engine of capitalism is wrong. Less and less people are surviving. We need to shift our behavior so that more can prosper, so that more can contribute, so that we've got less people literally just trying to eke out a living on a daily basis. And then, you know, the tragic thing is, in my experience, there's a lot of people, the lucky few, that have done well and continue to do well. But the tragedy is, as I've heard as a sort of long-time kind of business person, is that it's never enough, because they never find fulfillment by acquiring more and more of what they think is going to make them happy. And my direct experience has been, even for the wealthy or those who are well off, the greatest reward or the best thing they can enjoy is the fulfillment that comes through what they contribute to others. Because if it's all about just chasing money, or if it's all about, you know, I don't know, how many cars or holiday homes you have, my experience of people has been that they're still unhappy, that if you actually manage to sit down and have a quiet moment, they feel unfulfilled. And that was largely my experience. So I would characterize it in different terms. I would say it's not where I came from, but more some people are struggling to survive, some people are struggling to prosper, but many of those who are really trying to prosper are finding it unfulfilling because they're not making a contribution to others that really gives them fulfillment.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, sharing from my personal experience, I keep telling people as I make more money, I give more money.
Right.
Or I find myself getting more, I guess, liberal and straying away from the middle a little bit, less in terms of politics and more in terms of giving. And I think that's really interesting. I also thought it was interesting looking at your Twitter stream right now that Beth Cantor, who's a friend of the show, reviewed We First, and I'm interested to know what she thought of the book.
I saw the review this morning. She was particularly interested in the values that we're trying to instill into capitalism, in a sense that, you know, Beth is the absolute leading voice in the nonprofit world, and she's one of the people that inspired me to move into this space. I really had no relationships or no experience, and she was one of those voices who are tangibly, viscerally involved on a daily basis of making this happen. And, you know, I had the great pleasure of meeting her a few times now. And she was interested in, on the for-profit side, how we instill those values. And, you know, here's how I think about it. We are all trying to create a movement of change. You know, Blake of Tom's Shoes is changing the for-profit business model. Scott of Charity Water, Scott Harrison, is shifting the non-profit model. We've got Beth Cantor, who is, you know, providing such incredible insight on what to do on a daily basis. In that context, I see my role as being somebody to go into the large corporations around the country and make the business case for purposeful engagement, to talk about the return on investment for actually doing meaningful social outreach on the bottom line. Why? Because it allows you to build community. So how I see it is that we've all got this blanket of change. We're all grabbing a little bit of the blanket. We're all going to pull it together. And whether you're a mindful shopping mom at home or whether you're a Beth Cantor thought leader, all of us have a role to play. And Beth's support of We First, where she was very interested in how to bring those same values that inform nonprofits into the for-profit world. And, you know, one example was global citizenry. You know, companies need to realize, especially multinational companies, that they now have more influence than ever, both because their customers and consumers look to them for that, to play a greater role in social change if they want, you know, people to buy their product in return. But also the negative impact they have is very, very consequential around the world. And the people that used to make up for their excesses, government philanthropy, are struggling. So it's amplified or it's magnified their impact as well. So, you know, Beth has been a wonderful supporter, and I so appreciate her reviewing the book. And really, across the board, from the for-profit to the non-profit world, it's about instilling values again.
And so I think, you know, one of the interesting things is when you talk about values, and I'm looking through the different parts of the chapters of the book, you know, one of the things I wonder about is you know, really how you would distill the values of the book, because you get into that in part of the book, but I think I would love for you to be able to make that transparent, and I don't know if that's
no, absolutely, all that no, easy. It's not a problem.
Okay, go for it.
No, well, firstly, I mean, the book We First is a way of looking at the world. It is based on two fundamental premises, which is, one, we now live in a mutually dependent global community. What happens here in America impacts people on the other side of the world. What happens in Haiti, in Pakistan, in Japan, what happens on the stock market floor, it impacts everyone around the world. And there's no denying that anymore. That's one. The second premise is prosperity is not the wealth of a few, but the well-being of many. And what I mean by that is we can no longer keep creating, adding to the ranks of the poor, the erosion of the middle class, making fewer and fewer people wealthier, and expect the whole engine of capitalism, the well-being of society, to survive. It's just not realistic. It's not smart business. So the values of We First are really that we're in it together, that our self-interest needs to be moderated to include the 7 billion other people on the planet. So we need to work towards mutual self-interest. We need to appreciate that sometimes our self-interest is best served by fulfilling the self-interest of others. So we need to, you know, take a longer-term view on self-interest. So it doesn't mean we need to be any less self-interested than before. That's human nature. But we need to embrace an understanding of self-interest appropriate to the reality of the world we now live in, which is a complex and connected global community. And with that in mind, we need to expand our understanding of sustainability beyond the environment to include economic, moral, social, and ethical sustainability. And finally, we need to expand our understanding of profit. We can't separate out consumption and contribution. We need to integrate purpose into profit for businesses in the private sector. And that is a fundamental shift, because if we keep living in a profit for profit's sake world, we're losing sight of the fact that what it's costing us is more valuable than money. It's the well-being of our society, the ability of this society to function. So I would say it's a new definition of prosperity, it's a global community, and it's an expanded definition of self-interest, sustainability, and profit.
Interesting. So it's that wonderful mix of many. Now, it seems to me, I'm going to take put my researcher cap on for the book I'm writing on generational marketing and say that my guess is that this is an easier sell from a consumer point of view and even from a business point of view to younger people, to, as I mentioned before, the millennial generation. What are you finding is the case with older generations or older consumers, older business people? Is there any generational response to the different pieces of this?
You know, it's interesting. I haven't found that for two reasons. One, the baby boomer generation are struggling like never before. They all thought they were going to retire and have it easy. And the way the economy has played out and looks like it's going to play out in the future, that's not the case. So everyone's very engaged with this dialogue right now. Secondarily, the C-suite people of the world, the corporate executives, are understandably unsettled by changes in the marketplace. Look at the changes in the publishing industry, the movie industry, the music industry, you know, the magazine industry. As more and more eyeballs are moving online and more businesses going online and social media is playing an increasing role, their business models and their profit centers are shifting. So they're very, very engaged with two things. One, how do they survive? But secondly, how do they capitalize on this marketplace? And invariably, that means they've got to build communities, and these communities will become their brand advocates. They will help build their business for them. And how do they do that? They have to reach out to those communities and build them around shared values, because it's like being at a party at someone's house, and you walk into the room, and all you do is talk about yourself. People are not interested. But if you listen, and you find things that other people are interested in, and you talk and make a contribution to that conversation, then you're welcome and can stay. So the C-suite, the digital and social officers, the CMOs, the chief marketing officers, are very interested in this because they're interested in improving their profit by building communities through purposeful engagement, you know, around shared values. And then obviously you've got mums who are very, very busy but want to make a contribution through their daily wants and needs. And then you've got millennials who've got so much energy and so much optimism, and they want their own future, not their parents' past, and they want to build a better world. And so they're very engaged. So, you know, I have to say, hand on heart, and as a professional cynic, I've been inside the boardroom of a lot of different big companies over the last 8 months, evangelizing in a sense, and there is a genuine shift going on. Big brands are waking up. If you look at it and go, Nike, what Nike's doing with the Nike Green Exchange, or Starbucks Shared Planet, or Procter & Gamble Click for Water Blogovation campaign, or Pepsi Refresh Project, you know, it just goes on and on and on. Something's happening, and it's really exciting.
Absolutely. I think that's, you know, that's the wonderful part, is that you see a lot of very high-profile examples. Unfortunately, I'm going to take you to the dark side a little bit, just because
Please.
I think it's good to have a sense of, you know, when we're done, places people can go, companies people can take action with, whether they're working inside of them, with them, or purchasing from them that maybe have had, that maybe we can call out and say, maybe we could use an explanation on this, or or they could be doing better, and here's what we suggest. Are there companies that you're willing to be that broad, that ballsy about?
You know, I'm not aligned with any company, so I have no sensitivity in that sense, but I'm also mindful that what people value differs greatly. What might be important to me may not be important to somebody else. And you, there's no sort of 10 things to care about that everyone must subscribe to, in a sense. So that's one thing. Secondly, you know, there are some companies that are, you know, obvious targets, and rightly so. You know, I think tobacco companies don't really do anyone any favors. I mean, I don't see the merit of tobacco companies, and, you know, they may change their names, but I would like to think that, you know, they would shift their product lines to be more responsible and diversify, or, you know, evolve, which, you know, I'm certainly not the first or the last person to be, you know, critical of that industry. But beyond that, I think, you know, the oil and gas industry has come under attack lately for a lot of, you know, what's happened with, you know, oil spills and that sort of thing, you know, and I think there's an accountability that has to be there. But I think the best lens that people should look at is, who do they support in their own life through what they buy? We all live very different lives. We may run a farm, we may manage a business, we may be an employee of someone, we may be a Fortune 500 CEO. Take stock of all your wants and needs and look at the companies you support and go, in that category, is there somebody is doing a better job than someone else, somebody who's being more transparent or more authentic? And the way to engage them as a regular person, there's several things you can do. You can use social media to celebrate or admonish them, in the sense that if they do something good, tell everyone about it. If they do something bad, tell everyone about it. Secondly, you can embrace your role as a producer, curator, and distributor of content. So when you see somebody else being critical of something that you also care about, share that as well. Raise the volume of that conversation. Thirdly, you can start a movement yourself. You can say, you know what, I really do care about this issue, whether it's autism, breast cancer, or, you know, the wives, the widows of veterans, or whatever it might be, and rally a community around that, about around shared values, and align with brands that also care, and really just help those causes to be fulfilled. And so each of us individually need to go, hey, I'm a content and media company now. I have a voice. I effectively have a platform to make a difference, to create the change I want in the world. So of all the things I want and need each day, what's the best way to put those to use in terms of what I buy and then how I use social media to amplify a meaningful message?
So, you know, one of the comments, and I, as I'm having this offline discussion with folks on Twitter, is there's a community manager I respect greatly. But, and I warn everyone that on the weekends usually is the time that, you know, I am signing petitions, and the one, and I'm actually very selective about the ones that I think are important.
Right.
Urging people to do things. But when does it start to feel promotional? What is, you know, do you just say, I mean, what I've said is, I'm just going to have a limited Twitter following because I'm going to be preachy at times, but because people feel like if you ask them to sign something that it feels preachy, and I've tried phrasing it in different ways, and it's just the way it feels, and I just get less concerned about it. My business doesn't suffer from it, and everyone's aware of it. So what would you say to people that are afraid that that may happen to them?
Well, you know, it's an understandable concern, and I've gone through it myself. You know, I was just a regular guy with my friends and didn't put my opinions out there particularly loudly one way or another in recent years. And then suddenly this technology came and I cared enough to want to do something about it. And there's definitely those moments of discomfort where you go, are people going to be annoyed, or do they think it's inappropriate, or are they just going to kind of shut you down? But I think this is all a function of a larger shift that's going on, where we're going from living in private to living in public. And, you know, wonderful writers like Jeff Jarvis has a book coming out called Public Paths that talk all about the sort of publicness of our private lives. The same way we now share everything on Facebook and Twitter, you know, to varying degrees, we are now also being asked to kind of not be a brand in a sense, but certainly stand up for what we care about. And it takes a while, but you get unapologetic about that. You don't want to be annoying. You've got to be as sensitive as any brand out there to not really you know, annoy people and be obnoxious about it. And, you know, I've been very sensitive to that, hopefully, with We First, the book. But all you can do is say, you know what, this is who I am. This is what I care about. I realize that we are in trouble. I want to make a contribution myself, both because it'll help others and selfishly because I find it fulfilling myself. I'm going to do it in a tonal way that's appropriate to my friends and my community group. And if people really don't find it or find it annoying, and I've really been careful about how I did it and they still find it annoying, well, that's just the price of being somebody who's actively engaged in building a better world. And, you know, maybe you'll lose direct contact with a few people, but I'm sure you'll win a lot of other advocates. And, you know, it's hard to apologize for it in a sense, because we're now at a point where we're in sufficient trouble that we need to be engaged. We can no longer just sit back and do nothing. And it's really the ability of people to connect around what they care about that will scale change. And then suddenly, you know, things can take a turn for the better.
Yeah, we hope, right? One thing I have to ask you before, we're limited on time, but,
sure.
You know, this is such a big concept, and I think you've articulated it so well in a concise fashion. How long did it take you? I know so many people are writing books these days, and this seems to be one of those books that really does matter. We talked about what inspired you to write the book, but how long did it take from inspiration to publishing, and what was your publishing journey like?
Oh, my gosh. the stories I could tell you. I mean, I have never wanted to write a book in my life, ever. I had no contacts or relationships in the publishing industry. It was a blind, cold start. I walked into the kitchen and said to my wife, hey, I read this, you know, Bill Gates speech. Like, I think I want to write a book about it. And she was like, you know, one of those pauses. And she goes, sure, honey, that sounds great. You know, having no idea what was involved. It's about almost 4 years since I was standing in my backyard of my small house in L.A. You know, and I was in the backyard going, hey, I'm going to do this. You know, I'm feeling a bit lost and I'm going to do this. And then literally I started asking everyone about how to go about it, driving people nuts, I'm sure. I started following authors who had good books and watching their blog. And, you know, and the worst thing was social media was on the rise so much. So it wasn't just about writing a book and walking down the traditional path. It was like, no, you need to build a community beforehand. You need to be engaged. You need to, you know, really make a substantive commitment even before you've written the book. So, and then what I would do is, you know, I've got a very active professional consultancy business and I've got kids that I'm deeply committed to. So, you know, I'd come home at night and put the kids down and we'd have dinner and then I'd spend some time with my wife and then I'd start writing and I'd write, you know, till 2 or 2:30 in the morning each night. And I did that for a couple of years. Got really, really tired all the time to the point that I was driving around in L.A. like dizzy the whole time. So look out if you're
Uh-oh.
On the roads in L.A. I may be out there. then I started canvassing it around, trying to get an agent, and some people said no, and some people said yes, and it's been really humbling, because you think you're a kind of fancy-pants brand guy who knows what's going on. Had no idea what's going on. Secondly, had to start from scratch with no relationships, where nobody cares one way or another who you are. Thirdly, it is a labor of love. I mean, you put in... I mean, tens of thousands of hours unpaid, countless, countless hours. I mean, whether it's the number of blog posts you write or the follow-ups you do or the Twitter streams you manage or the book itself, which you have to write. I handed in the manuscript and it was twice as long as it should have been. And my wonderful editor, you know, Palgrave and Millen said, love it, and cut it in half. And I was like, what? That's like saying, you know, you can have half of your body. Which half do you want, you know? So it was a whole kind of thing of mistakes and accidents, and the greatest reward for me, honestly, has been that the message is resonating. I don't know that people, unless they have an extraordinary success, ever make, you know, money out of writing a book these days. You know, I'm not really cued in on how much that happens and how much it doesn't, but the fulfillment, the reward for me has been the satisfaction of actually finding some alignment between who I am and what I'm doing on a daily basis and using my skills as a brand guy to make a contribution. And then also to the brand, if you're a brand or a small brand or a Fortune 500 company and you want to know how to make money by building a community while also having a positive impact, this book will tell you how to do it. And if I enable some brands to be more effective about that, to improve their bottom line, but also have a greater positive impact, I won the lottery.
Yeah, I mean, there is a significant impact on your personal, what you mean as a person in the world and what it means to do business with you. Because I think, you know, moving forward, it will probably initially help people. So I guess in terms of your journey, what do you think the next steps are? Because it sounds like this has been a significant not only achievement, but it's significantly made you think about the world a different way, probably think
yeah.
about your business dealings a different way. So how or will you approach different things differently these days?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to work with clients, for-profit or non-profit, on the basis of the positive impact they want to have. I want to work with any Fortune 500 brand or mid-sized company or small company that is looking to engage a community and have a positive impact. And the same with nonprofits. How to be more effective in terms of fundraising and storytelling, which makes your messaging that much more effective. And then, you know, if I had to sum up the whole process, it really is about self-definition. I think most of us in life are so busy with the day-to-day and with our kids and getting shopping done and paying the gas bill that we rarely get the luxury to sit down and go, who am I? What do I stand for? What do I care about? And how do I bring that to life in the world? And the real benefit of this for me has been by writing the blog, I was forced to work that out. And it provided great fulfillment and satisfaction for me personally. And I think a lot of us, without that, can get to 40 or 50 or when your kids leave home or whatever, and you go, who am I? And who's that partner that I've been married to for 15 years? And what was that career I just had? And why don't I feel fulfilled? And oh, my God, what's going to happen with the world for my kids? And why is everything so screwy, you know, in terms of the way the world is being run? And so by engaging in a dialogue with yourself of self-definition, you start to address those core issues that really dictate your experience of life, particularly as you get older. So it is very selfish in a sense, but it's incredibly rewarding, both in terms of your bottom line as a business leader, but also on a personal self-satisfaction level, which is sometimes a greater wealth in a sense.
I don't think many of us would think the journey that you've been on is a very selfish one, because the outcome definitely benefits all of us. I have been honored to have an advanced copy of your book, and I thank you so much for that. And I encourage people, we've got a preview for the book. It is out officially tomorrow. So
yep,
you've been on the Amazon.com bestseller pre-order list for some time.
I heard that this morning, and I was like so blown away. You have no idea. In terms of being an author, you're just in a vacuum, and you're running around, like in Australia we say, a headless chook. You're running around trying to do everything you can because you're sort of like a, you know, just trying to market and get it out there your own way. And I was so thrilled this morning. And I just think, you know, this is a message that is resonating because we all want to see more positive change. We all want to be a bit more helpful. We all want to be less terrified by these changes in the marketplace, the social business marketplace. And we want to feel more capable of leveraging that effectively to improve our bottom line so our company isn't irrelevant, so we don't lose our jobs, so that we can be a little bit more hopeful in the future. And, you know, I really appreciate your support. It is, and, you know, for your listeners for listening in, I would invite you to visit wefirstbook.com and, you know, order a copy and see how it might be useful for you in terms of community building and having positive impact and improving your profits. But also, you know, I'd love you to share it with a boss who needs to hear this message, or I'd love you to share it with a friend or a grad student who's just come out of school and wants to build a business but wants to do it in a meaningful way. Because I spent 3 years doing the research into the latest in mobile gaming and social technology and really thought through how do you use that to build community more effectively and stuff. And I think it can really save people a lot of heavy lifting and get them to a place that will allow them to be more successful more quickly. So the website is wefirstbook.com.
That's fabulous. WeFirstBook.com. Everything's linked on my website, JenniferNeely.com. And we have a number of links on our Blog Talk Radio page, which will hopefully filter over to iTunes where most of our listeners get this from. Simon, this has been fantastic. I think you may be an author from now on. Who knows?
Oh, you know what? The way I look at it, you're asking kindly before about how I see my future. I'm deeply, deeply committed to being the hacker in the boardrooms of America that goes in and makes the business case for purposeful engagement. You know, you're doing your role by amplifying messages out there. You know, as I said, Scott Harrison and Blake Mikowski and others are doing their own thing. Each of us needs to, specific to our skill sets, play a role. And mine is going to be to help business make a greater contribution because it's in their interests as well. In this social business marketplace, if you're not meaningful to your customer base, you will not survive. So how do we do that? And what a wonderful moment we all live in. We all live in a moment where it really, for the first time, doing good is good for business in the social business marketplace. So let's all like go like hell and make it happen.
Fantastic. Simon, I'm going to let you go, and you can shield us from the Los Angeles, or I guess you're in New York.
I just arrived, yeah.
The New York sounds in the background. I thank you so much for joining us. Again, the URL is wefirstbook.com, which I will link through all the usual sources. And I want to thank all of our guests for tuning in. But Simon, we'll let you go. Feel free to hang up the phone. And thank you so much again for being a part of the show.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. And thanks, Jennifer. So appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Simon.
Bye-bye.
And again, I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning into the A-List with me, Jennifer Neely, and as you've just heard, Simon Mainwaring, who just wrote the book We First, which correlates well with his the brand of his business, which is We First Branding. And he's a fantastic person. We didn't get into a lot of his personal accomplishments and conferences that he's gone to, but he was at the Cannes International Film Festival, and you know, we could go on and on with the kinds of questions that he must have been raised or been thinking about in dealing with Hollywood as a subset of all of the different industries that we've discussed. I hope that you've enjoyed this program, and if so, we'd love it if you'd be so kind as to friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio, or subscribe and rate us over on iTunes. We can always only get better if you let us know what we can do. And as always, be a participant. Send us your questions. We're open to them via Twitter, Facebook, and of course, email. Mail it to me if you have to. Or call me. There's nothing off limits. Obviously, those other ways are nice and transparent, so everybody gets to hear what's being asked. But the main thing is that we have you contributing to the program. As always, you can keep up with the latest on this show archives and free informational webcasts, as well as more that's going on, like the social media marketing boot camp I'm doing for Media Bistro, the San Francisco State teaching that I'm doing, hoping to do more to empower the world to use social media for their own purposes, their own the greater good of empowerment. And want to thank you so much for joining us. This has been a really special show for me because it really does resonate with what I try to do through this show. So I want to thank Simon deeply for joining this show, and thank you again to each and every one of you who've been listening, following my live tweeting, and getting involved in any way you can. Watch for that book coming out tomorrow called We First. Thanks again.